Thank you, Laura. Good morning. Good to see all of you. So similar to Rebecca's opening points in general, I've been a bit reluctant myself to when we talk about the vulnerabilities of children, to really get into that corner of almost at some point, this was maybe 7-8 years ago, getting called a lot to quantify the health and well-being of a child. I mean, how do you really do that? At what variance do you use? And, you know, whose life is, if you will, more beneficial than the other? I mean, those are kind of the places that we were getting, that we were kind of forced into years back. I'm happy to say that even in the emerging peer-reviewed science and some of the connections that you're hearing that Laura's been talking about and that I'll be talking about as well, I believe that the case is much stronger and that we don't necessarily have to be pigeonholed, but there are certainly stories to be told where it's a win-win, where this, when you combine the science in the field to protection, to focusing on prevention and protection and primary prevention versus treatment all the time, which we traditionally have been, and the benefits cost-wise, it's really a win-win. So I hope I can help make the case for you here today on that. I always like to start with some inspirational thoughts. So here's one from Nelson Mandela. There can be no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way in which it treats its children. Oops, sorry. Children are our most valuable resource. That's from our 31st U.S. president. And the public health community's voice has always been vital to climate change, our obligation to speak for children's health, and to protect it as clear as ever. Our U.S. EPA Administrator, Gina McCarthy. Just kind of keeping that in the back of your mind here. I don't have any relationships to disclose. So a little on the Children's Environmental Health Network. We are a national nonprofit. We've been around for over almost 25 years now. We've got our start out in California, actually in the Bay Area. Our mission has always been the same, and that's to make sure that all children have the right to a healthy and safe set of environments where they play, eat, pray, just explore and enjoy life. And of course, those environments should be nurturing to their growth and development and not hindering, which we know, unfortunately, is not the case for many, many children just in this country alone. The way that we attain those goals are to first educate and train, build awareness. From where I stand, I've been with the organization 14 years and in this field a little longer than that, but from where I stand, we still have a lot of gaps as far as general education and awareness. And certainly when we tag on the cost-benefit piece, we certainly have a lot of information that can be bridged among even those that you would expect should know some of this by now. But please understand, we still have a lot of basic education and training to do among various stakeholders. We promote peer-reviewed science. We wouldn't be anywhere. We wouldn't have any grounding on any training and education without the peer-reviewed science. Again, in the last 2 decades, a lot more has come. We have wonderful researchers in the room and beyond and at this conference and, again, beyond that have made it their life's ambition and priority to make sure that we have that groundbreaking science. Now we need to continue to translate it for the lay public to use. And, of course, the hardest, which is to promote child protective policies. We focus mostly at the state level, the federal level, but we certainly do advise and do what we can at the state level since a lot more has been happening at the state level in the last few years. So it's extremely important to support our states and localities. And at the end of the day, we want to be able to identify opportunities to constantly be improving, constantly raising the bar, constantly asking all of ourselves, our federal partners, our non-federal partners, our associations, our healthcare practitioners, and on, our individuals, our schools, our childcare. What else can we be doing to make sure that we are really producing the most conducive environments for the protection and positive development of our children? Yeah, this looks like it could be my house on any given day, but again, children are unique. They have unique vulnerabilities just by what they're doing. They're on the ground. They're exploring as they should be. They're putting their hands in their mouth. These are all things that they should be doing. Most of us as adults usually aren't doing those things anymore, but it's kind of fun to be out on the ground and having fun with your kids, grandkids, nieces. But all of those behaviors put them in harm's risk, and unfortunately, this is still the case. Of course, all their systems are still developing, their respiratory, their neurological systems, their hormonal systems all are developing, so all of those are at risk for inappropriate and not development as though it should naturally be happening. So they also have this latency effect that is quite critical, and when we get into the cost-benefit piece, they have longer longevity of disease, potentially, longer latency of early onset, for example, that we might not see that develops into disease further in life, cancer of many sorts being just one example. So the lifelong damage is really critical here when we start thinking about the costs to the life of that child. Children are exposed through a wide variety of different ways, through their skin and eye contact, and of course prenatal exposures, ingestion, drinking, and eating. Now, there are all kinds of early onset, as we know. We know that what a child is exposed to, even in the womb, as their quote-unquote first environment, is very critical. Also, what their fathers are exposed to. Some genetic connections are also very clear. We know that there are a variety of pediatric health challenges that have shifted. We used to be dealing with a bunch of infectious diseases and polios and tuberculosis, but now we're now dealing with the serious chronic illnesses. We have no handle on asthma. At one point, asthma was stagnant, and actually in the nation's health, I think it was last year, we started seeing some rises in childhood asthma again. We are obviously just as much in the middle of an obesity, overweight epidemic. Biggest growth period happening in the age of adolescence, in particular adolescent girls. We are in the midst of many different epidemics here that have serious cost implications, however you define cost, for lifetime, and not just this generation, but generations to come. Of course, the child's environment plays a huge role in their exposure and their likelihood of having chronic illness. And we know that, again, environmental factors may play, well, I heard Laura talked about 80%, depending on, but when we're talking about developmental health defects, we know that at least 25% of those cases are related to environmental exposures, many of which are preventable. So many of you have seen this slide before. This, I think, pretty much nails it for me. Again, many of us have been in this a long time. Many folks have dedicated their entire careers to trying to reverse these trends. They're all going the wrong way, every single one of them. If you're using health outcomes for children as a major marker, we need to be turning every single one of these around. This is serious. So when we look at cost benefits, there's certainly some, again, flaws as we see it from the children's health perspective, but of course benefits in looking at the child lens. But I want to acknowledge the flaws as we see them. Regulatory analysis can undervalue children and lead to a policy that does not really sufficiently protect children's health. Traditional discounting methods have reduced the long-term effects of benefits, like preventing chronic illness in the first place. They really haven't been magnifying that benefit to the extent that it needs to be. Benefits to preventing detrimental health outcomes can be difficult to quantify and, again, work into the traditional cost-benefit analysis framework. So there are a lot of intangibles, and again, at the end of the day, like I was saying earlier, how can we really put a price on that of a life? You know, how do you really do that in the most fair way? So this is 2008, some aggregate costs of environmental-mediated diseases in U.S. children that health affairs looked at. So it's quite interesting when you look at base case estimate that pretty much they're saying that roughly a total of a little over $76 billion is what we are spending, or at least what we spent in 2008, in child health-related, environmental health-related diseases in this country, which is pretty huge. The need for prevention. Again, there are lots of cases being made that if instead of focusing on treatment, and inevitably those costs will continue to exacerbate, healthcare continues to go up. That's not, again, the public health model, that there are many benefits to preventing illness, not only for the health and well-being of that children and their families and their longitudinal education journey and their professional and just general growth, but also just the fact that it costs less in many cases. So a 2011 study that the Urban Institute did found that the American healthcare system spends roughly $238 billion annually for excess costs. And those are defined as the difference between costs of care for people with preventable chronic illness and those with total without illness. So, you know, in those cases, you're looking at infant deaths, deaths from cardiovascular diseases, diabetes incidents, and cancer incidents, just to name a few. Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation also showed that an investment of just $10 per person per year is a proven community-based health program could help save the U.S. up to $6 billion a year. $10. Oh, sorry. So that was a return on pretty much just under $6 on every dollar invested. So any economics major can, you know, figure out how much of a benefit that is. So if you look at just some case examples in asthma, lead, obesity, and climate change, I just want to, again, help to intrigue you a bit here. There are some studies conducted that also apply to lead, and this was in the Environmental Health Perspectives peer-reviewed journal not that long ago, to determine the percentage of a particular disease category that would be eliminated if environmental health risk factors were reduced to their lowest feasible levels. And this is called an environmentally attributable fraction, or EAF. So 30% of the EAF for pediatric asthma was determined. Environmentally attributable costs ranging from $0.7 billion to $2.3 billion. But then an air pollution study showed an increase monthly of $123 increase in charge to a patient hospitalized and a $47 increase in costs. When we look at PM2.5 and ozone, both contribute, as we know, to poor air quality, of course, exacerbation of asthma, and a range of respiratory issues, especially among our youngest, our children. Regulations of these air pollutants, what they call the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, or NAAQS, by the EPA, do not necessarily consider the cost, but there is a regulatory impact assessment that's completed with a cost-benefit analysis for public information, which is very helpful to us if you're able to kind of weed through it all. For particulate matter, in 2013, the NAAQS using a standard and a discount rate of 7% in 2010 dollars, estimated that if we're spending roughly $53 to $350 million on, you know, respiratory issues in relationship to particulate matter, the estimated benefits, if we were to invest that in 1 year, would be in these huge amounts, in the millions, you know, tripling, quadrupling our investment. For ozone, reaching, looking at standards in 2020 at a 7% discount rate, excluding non-attainment and designations, if we roughly spent, you know, on the high end, up to $25 billion a year on trying to reduce that ozone, we would have quantifiable benefits between $11 to $31 billion. Now, there's not a full report available, but again, these general estimates are made for us and available for our use. For lead, the environmentally attainable general estimates are made for us and available. Pretty much can prevent lead. There's not more science that's needed in lead. We know that the major routes of exposure are still the old lead-based paint, the old lead piping that we have throughout the country, just to name a few of major routes of exposure. So there is a way, you know, that we can attribute 100% those exposures to environmentally attainable fractions. So the total cost of pediatric lead poisoning is estimated to be about $43 billion annually. An Economic Policy Institute study looked and estimated that the elevated blood levels among a cohort of children under six found that for every dollar invested in lead paint hazard control returns anywhere from $17 to $21 for a net savings of $181 to $269 billion. Again, basic economics here. The cost range of lead paint hazard control anywhere from $1 to $11 billion per year for the cohort of children also showed that treating lead for children's blood for the cohort of the same year, and this was in 2006, which included medical treatment, lost earning, tax revenue, special education, attention deficit, hyperactivity-linked cases, and criminal activity, was anywhere from $172 to $270 billion. So again, which would we rather keep paying? We're on this trajectory that makes no economic sense, certainly has no health benefits, and is not looking at the future prevention of the illness in the first place. When we look at obesity and the overweight epidemic, we have potential for huge, massive savings with prevention, but it is hard at times, of course, to quantify. Many diseases that result from obesity, like diabetes, hypertension, many of which, of course, are manifesting in much younger patients than ever before, they don't necessarily manifest themselves until after adulthood, but again, as we know, the trends, children are getting these adult-onset diseases much earlier in life. Trust for America's Health has estimated increased healthcare costs for obese children to be roughly $19,000 per year for a 10-year-old that is obese, and that obese children have $194 higher outpatient visit expenditures, $114 higher prescription drug expenditures, and $25 higher emergency room expenditures in a 2-year medical expenditure panel survey. So being overweight or even obese as a child is associated with a $14.1 billion additional prescription drug, emergency room, and outpatient visit costs annually for the United States. That's roughly now. That's not as we will continue to get into the future. State-by-state potential healthcare cost savings by 2030, if states reduce average body mass index by just 5%, are extremely huge, ranging between $1 to $81 billion and costs saved. Possible costs to reducing obesity, of course, include exercise. So it could be going out and joining a gym for $20 to more a month, or it could not be. It could be just going outside and walking and using green space or any other form of activity that does not require any cost other than your time and energy. Programs for healthy eating, for example, National School Lunch Program costs, roughly cost the U.S. $11.6 billion in FY 2012. But again, we know that there are a range of benefits to revamping the National School Lunch Program, which if any of you remember when you were going to school, when I was going to school, they needed to have a serious overhaul, quite frankly, just as far as the nutrient value, nonetheless, you know, what was being offered and really promoting best practices. Okay, thank you. When we look at climate change, the National Resources Defense Council looked at types of events that are likely to harm human health and worsen. So ozone, smog pollution, heat waves, hurricanes, mosquito-borne infectious diseases, and on. The health costs for climate events in the past have included California heat wave in 2008 was cost us about $5 billion. The North Dakota flooding in 2009 was cost about $20 million. The Louisiana West Nile virus in 2002, $207 million. Hurricane Sandy, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Superstorm Sandy cost us $75 billion worth of damage in the U.S., second only to Hurricane Katrina. Nearly $180 million went to the New York University Medical Center, and $130 million to New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation. So a lot focused, again, on treatment and all of the nuances that have to come after such a tragedy like that. Full cost-benefit analysis for climate change deals with a large amount of uncertainty. However, overall health costs incurred are only projected to rise, as, of course, a lot of these natural events will continue to happen in addition to heat waves and natural disasters. I do want to mention that just in October, the Children's Environmental Health Network had a monumental milestone. We had a Wingspread Summit in Racine, Wisconsin. This is the Johnson Family Foundation hosts this. It's a pretty big deal. National Public Radio, for example, came out of a Wingspread Summit. What we're trying to do is we're trying to revamp how we look at addressing children's environmental health in the U.S., taking lessons learned, many more partners in the ground than when we started 20 years ago, investments, especially on the research front. But at the end of the day, that slide that I showed with all the health outcomes going the wrong way, we need to be reversing that. The needle needs to move quicker than it has been. So a group of visionary leaders, a small group came together. We had urban planners in the room, economists, lawyers, researchers, all kinds of folks, community voices, tribal leaders. And we came out with a statement, kind of a renewed vision of where we know we need to be going, inclusive of the broadening of the net that needs to happen in order to make the type of systems change, community-level changes that we need to have. I would offer, and we're now building a blueprint for action, which you will see at some point into the new year. I'm offering that the cost-benefit piece certainly has to be a huge driving force in any type of blueprint for action for protecting our kids. There's a huge opportunity there to be looking through the lens of a child. These are just some of the crucial aspects that were involved in the vision statement. We need to be mobilizing greater societal understanding of children's environmental health with a strong priority on children and families. Creating knowledge essential for action and using knowledge that we have now. Again, you can't do that without the increased science. We need to marshal the engine of the economy to achieve environments where children can actually thrive. And we need to build the political will in our institutions of government for child-centered policies. So thank you. These are my three little ones that keep me inspired out of millions every single day, and appreciate all of your time and energy. It's a good question. I mean, at the end of the day, I think, again, we in public health need to sit back, and this is what we're doing too, and look at what has already been accomplished, because I think that we haven't been so good at quantifying the progress that has been made. So even as we get into newer, if you will, epidemics like obesity and the overweight epidemic, we have the traditional model of lead. That's like the traditional children's environmental health model. And I think it's been almost until more recently, I'd say in the last decade, maybe last half decade, where we started to see peer-reviewed literature. Those have actually been able to take the time out of their busy advocacy and research efforts to actually help us look at the lay of the land. Look, we've all seen the graphs. By reducing lead in gasoline, we saw a huge return on all kinds of investments and benefits to the entire society, especially our most vulnerable. So we might not always have that nice little, I mean, we still have a lot to do in lead poisoning, don't get me wrong, but we saw a drastic impact due to efforts, policies enacted that had a direct return on health and well-being for our societies as a whole. We don't always have that cross-cutting analogy. So we need to be looking for they're there, but it takes time. And so one thing that we're doing is starting to align with economists. This isn't what I do on a regular basis. I need to help get some assistance from the folks that can help us quantify the progress that has been made to help make the story much more applicable to the average person that can actually do something with it. So that's one way that we've been doing it, aligning ourselves with those who speak in these jargons all the time, who work with the numbers, who know how to make a message, not create something that's not there, but to pull out the message that is there that many of us just haven't had the ability to do on our own. That's one way. But if there's others that... I think that's where we're going. I mean, especially for the naysayers, we are definitely at a roadblock. We don't need to talk about the last elections and how much more of a challenge it's going to continue to be to get any formidable policies, public health policy, nonetheless, child protective policies enacted at the federal level anyway. States are still moving and shaking, and they'll still continue to have their challenges too. But I think for the naysayers out there, it's a win-win when you combine the science, even though people still question the science, but the science is what the science is, especially when you have more emerging science saying the same story, when you have the realities of the health outcomes that we're talking about, and now you connect it to the benefits, the cost benefits, if we're spending less and we're getting bigger return, it's a win-win. So it's like it's the communication in general of how all of us need to be helping to piece together the story that's there and amplifying it. A lot of us in children's environmental health don't have marketing departments and things like that. I mean, we don't have the benefits, the luxuries of these kind of things. So it's broadening our partnership net so that we can help make the cases that are there, that are that are totally compelling, and where you would not, you would feel shame to be on the other side of the story. Because what's the other side? I mean, it's going against children. Wingspread, yes. So there was an original blueprint, if you will, that started over two decades ago when the field of children's environmental health emerged. So the Children's Environmental Health Network, among many partners, was a part of that. This is a renewed blueprint. So there was an original blueprint that called for the Office of Child Health Protection to be created at the EPA to have some regulatory voice on children's health at the EPA. There was the blueprint that called for an research agenda. We never had a research agenda on how do we even start to prioritize what our researchers are looking at to help benefit the field. Now, two decades into this, it was time to reassess. So the blueprint is not the first of its kind. It's a renewed, updated one, if you will, from where we all stand. And then the point is to then offer it out and to shepherd it and to help integrate it into already existing well-respected science-based campaigns, efforts, of course, our federal partners. So the point is to get engagement on it in this development, but more importantly, to offer it as a tool, as in these resource times, limited capacity, HUD, I imagine you guys have more than enough work that you could be doing, but the reality is you can only do so much. So for whatever it's worth, if our blueprint could be helpful and hopefully align with the goal settings that you all have and your strategic vision, it will help prioritize some of us and increase the partnership and leverage our abilities together to make that needle move more for the protection of children than it has been. That's the aim anyway. Thank you.